Now, last time, I said, why France? And the answer was obvious. It was France, the country that any revolutionary in Europe would look to, quite clearly. It is France which, in the 1830s, became, as I said last time, the laboratory of a revolution. The French revolutionary model will persist. Paris will be vital as the capital of revolutionary and socialist thought. Then in 1870, there will come the Paris Commune. Even when Marx went to London, he still very largely looked to France. Thus, the French experience came on top of his Hegelianism. The French experience gave him in the practicality. The Hegelian experience gave him, if you like, his system. But as far as this system is concerned, it is quite clear, and I must remind you now of it again, that Hegel rejected the idealism of his fellow students, of the young Hegelians, largely under the influence of his stay in France. Nevertheless, from the beginning to end, another kind of idealism stayed with Marx, a kind of residue of his Hegelian system, namely the primacy of the human mind, the emphasis upon consciousness, the humanism which he now talks about. How long he kept this kind of humanism is perhaps the most disputed single thing among Marxist scholars. Was it still dominant after 1859, after the Critique of Political Economy, or not? Just in the last years, Althusser in France has denied that there is that difference between the young and the old Marx, and that is perhaps the cardinal problem in Marxist studies. This difference between the young Marx and the old Marx. Did he drop the basis of his Hegelian idealism, his emphasis on human consciousness, for a greater determinism after the Critique of Political Economy, that is, after 1859? But what you will read is, of course, the young Marx, the German ideology of 1846. And to this I now want to turn, because it means another stage in Marx's development. He has already rejected the Hegelian state under his influence in France, even if he kept the Hegelian system and even much of the idealism in the Hegelian system, the idea of consciousness. But in the German ideology, he is concerned with the second pillar of Hegelianism, of older Hegelianism, of all Hegelianism, Christianity. And what you see developing as you read the German ideology is his rejection of the second presupposition of these young students. He's rejected the idea of the state, and now he will reject that Christianity is the enemy to be fought and to be defeated, that if you have defeated Christianity, that then you have a new society, something which is basic in the young Hegelians, as I have told you before. Here he attacks Feuerbach, who had been himself a young Hegelian, under whose influence Marx had been very much indeed. Indeed, in the German ideology, he attacks Feuerbach and Feuerbach's critique of Christianity, then, as the way to the good society, as the enemy to be defeated, And on a very obvious level, he substitutes for that the social and economic conditions. In other words, you again see the influence of France here, the influence of France as over against the influence of Germany. And yet, even in this attack, I point out to you, the emphasis on consciousness is still clear. For what happens still is that consciousness with Marx evolves from a primitive form until it clashes with the division of labor. And in a sense, the turning point of your entire Marx reading is the division of labor. It is on that point that Feuerbach's analysis becomes obsolete, that he took no account of the division of labor. And the division of labor, which you have in Hegel as well, Marx now equates, as did Hegel, with alienation. But the division of labor is no longer a theoretical construct, but a concrete product of European industrialization. No longer theoretical, but concrete. And yet, as you read the German ideology, and especially as you read the so famous thesis on Feuerbach, the thesis on Feuerbach, which is the kind of supplementary text that you should read, the only supplementary text here you should read. These theses of Feuerbach, which become famous, oddly enough, were never published during Marx's lifetime. They are the basis of the book, but they were not published. They were published only by Friedrich Engels in 1888. But I dare say nothing is more famous than Marx's thesis on Feuerbach, because they give in distilled form really much of the argument of the crisis of the German ideology, much of the argument of the German ideology. Now notice about them that it has the essence of Marx, because always in the most famous passages, which I will now read you, should know them by heart, Marx intertwines human consciousness and material factors. They are always intertwined. The social and economic reality of the division of labor and the progression in history of human consciousness, which you have studied and which you know from your Hegel reading, the sixth famous thesis. Feuerbach resolves the religious essence into a human essence, but the human essence is no abstraction inherent in each single individual. It is the ensemble of social relations. That is to say, the essence of the criticism of Feuerbach, you should really read this before you read the rest of the text, that Feuerbach abstracts, makes it theoretical. That doesn't deny that there is a human essence, but the human essence is defined in this world through the totality, and we shall come back to that, of social relations. And then, do I have to read it to you, the last thesis, most famous, the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. In other words, what he's again saying is that Feuerbach abstracts and does not lead to concrete action. But what it also means, and this becomes more and more important as we go on, that Marx believed what you no longer have in Engels, and certainly not in the Bolsheviks, in the mixture of philosophy and social reality, that there can be no social reality analysis without true consciousness, that the primary fact is, if I can put it technically, cognition, but that can be no cognition without social reality. And what you have here really is the kind of fusing of reality and consciousness that you have in Hegel. How Hegel fused consciousness in history. Here you see reality and consciousness fused. This is then the essence of Marx, the Hegelian Marx, man and history, the necessity of theory, if I can put it in more modern terms, the necessity of revolutionary theory. And secondly, France, the necessity of practical action in a real situation, defined as a totality of social factors. That, after all, is France. Now, where in all of this does Feuerbach enter? And that, I think, will make it still clearer. Feuerbach had influenced the young Marx very strongly, all young Hegelians, with his analysis of religion. For Feuerbach's analysis of religion was that religion is created by man for his own purpose. That religion is created by man for his own purposes. That religion is a projection of man's, if we would say today, wish fulfillment. That in, as it were, this matter of projection of religion, what man is really doing is fulfilling his wishes, his wish to be dependent. So that, in a sense, religion caters to the worst side of man, his necessity for dependence. Religion is a symbolic language, which is the story of creation. It is the story of dependence, of man's alienation. Religion is simply a way of getting around man's alienation. Man invented God. Feuerbach has that very famous saying, not as it's usually said, man is what he eats. That's how it's put crudely. But Feuerbach really means a man is detached from any kind of cosmic forces. That man is, in other words, what he makes of himself. His own wishes and hopes. And religion, therefore, is a product of what we should call anthropology. Religion is a product of anthropology. Christianity, of course, is a product of anthropology. To put it in a nutshell, what he actually says as follows. Religion, writes Feuerbach, is a dream, a fantasy picture, which expresses man's situation and at the same time provides a fantasy gratification of man's wish to overcome his alienation. Religion is therefore primarily practical rather than theoretical. It is an art of life. In religion, man recognizes his helplessness, his dependence, and he seeks to overcome it by calling in the aid of the imagination. Sacrifice and prayer thus stand at the very center of religion and reveal to us its essential character and aim. The ground of sacrifice is dependence. The result of sacrifice is self-confidence. In other words, religion is a reflection of man. It gives man self-confidence. It's invented by man as a crutch, perhaps that better. It is nothing else, really, but an illusion, a crutch. And Feuerbach goes further and says that is why it is so easily manipulated for oppression by present governments. And again, he was thinking of the government of Frederick William IV of Prussia, which indeed used Lutheranism, Calvinism, the Prussian state church in that manner. Man is the center. That's what he means when he says man is what he eats. Man is the center. But man for him also was an abstraction. That is quite clear. And his solution was the abolition of religion and the institution of political democracy. Here he was typical for the young Hegelians. Feuerbach's solution was the abolition of religion and the institution of political democracy. That is quite clear, and you will find it reflected in your book. His critique, again, is a political critique. Now, Feuerbach, no doubt, was Marx's liberation. It was Marx's liberation inasmuch as through Feuerbach, such ideas about religion as he may have had, such ideas about forces extraneous to man himself, dropped away. And from now on, from 1846, whatever we can say about Marx and consciousness, the old Marx against the young Marx, the Marx of a determinist nature or not, one thing is quite clear. After 1846, his theory was centered on man himself and not hyphenated man, not man and God or man and natural law or man and Christianity. Man for Marx was no longer hyphenated, even hyphenated as he'd been in the Enlightenment, not man and natural laws. God for Marx was an invention of man. God was an invention of man. And he now passed to an analysis of man himself. So much of Feuerbach's critique remains alive and will remain alive. When you read your book here on the German ideology, please remember something else too, which I must say now as you are starting reading it. All Marx's writings are polemical, except perhaps The Capital. But even Das Kapital is partly polemical. Because like any young revolutionary, his thesis was stimulated by his enemies. Can't be a revolutionary without enemies. Yeah? You can't be a revolutionary without enemies. And Marx from the French Revolution knew something that has since been forgotten by the younger generation. I remember, I must tell a story here, I remember that during our student riots, I had clashed with the students on something or other. Never took it very seriously, so I amused myself by goading them. And the leaders of these students came to me afterwards and said, "Professor Mosse, we hope you won't resign." And I say, "Don't you know, as radicals, the famous saying, first of Robespierre and then of all revolutionaries, that any revolution must step over corpses." See? So Marx assumed that. Any revolutionary would assume it who wasn't, like our students, simply a play within a play, a bourgeois revolution against the bourgeoisie, that sort of thing. But anybody else would realize that. So that is why his writings are so highly polemical, because in a sense, he was isolated. He was alone. He had no real followers except Engels, and Engels eventually lived in Manchester, quite far away. So as any isolated thinker, he had to, fertilize his thought through his enemies. He had to push himself along through his enemies. And he discovered many of his theories were discovered through polemics. That is why your reading is highly polemical. It is anti-Feuerbach. Feuerbach liberated Marx, and now Marx is liberating himself from Feuerbach. To summarize, what I've tried to say is that Marx had rejected the primacy of the state, and now he rejects the target of the young Hegelians, religion. He has rejected the primacy of the state, now he rejects it. And if you read page 40 to 41, I won't do it for you, of your German ideology reading, you will see his criticism. The entire body of German philosophical criticism, he says, is confined to criticism of religious conceptions. Yes? It's all conceptions, religious conceptions. And therefore, again, what they're tilting at is for Marx now an illusion. As he puts it on page 41 in your reading, since the young Hegelians consider conceptions, thoughts, and ideas, in fact, all the products of consciousness, to which they attribute an independent existence as the real chains of men, it is evident that the young Hegelians have to fight only against these illusions. In other words, what he is now criticizing, what he now has the liberation to criticize, is the abstraction. That doesn't mean he doesn't believe in consciousness. But the thing about Marx is, Marx is in a sense a truer Hegelian here than the Hegelians, because Marx believes in the interpenetration of human consciousness and reality, while the young Hegelians believe that consciousness has a life of its own, that all that is important is mediation, as I discussed it to you once before, that is the absorption by consciousness of reality, that all that is important is mediation. But in reality, of course, that leads to an abstraction. Now, it is interesting to see, as we shall see all along, that like Bruno Bauer, whom I talked about last time, who came to believe in the liberal state, Feuerbach eventually became a German nationalist. That eventually all these people could not withstand the excitement of German unification. They all became German nationalists in the end. Now, the criticism of religion will remain and will, for Marx, be a tool, really. The criticism of religion will, for Marx, be a tool for the criticism of society. And here, the most famous work is the work of Marx about the Jews. The work of Marx about the Jews and the Jewish religion on Judaism, originally some quite far apart spaced articles. Now, I must say something about that, perhaps at greater length than it's warranted. Because today, this book, with all its anti-Semitism and self-hate, which is undoubtedly present and is not surprising. This isn't 1980. This isn't after the ethnic revolution in America. Until the 1960s, every minority hated itself. That's clear, whether it was Jews who had self-hate. After all, remember, you could only be admitted to a Jewish fraternity at the University of Wisconsin if you looked Christian, just as blacks brought hair straighteners. So every minority before the ethnic revolution, that's what's been so great about the ethnic revolution, had more than its share of self-hate. And Karl Marx had it at the beginning of emancipation. Marx was only the second generation of emancipated Jews. Only the second generation. In fact, emancipation is just 6 years before he was born. 6 years, the ghetto walls had fallen, and not everywhere. Not in Italy, in the middle of Europe, ghetto walls had not yet fallen. So that he is only the second generation. So that to see him filled with Jewish self-hate, in a sense, is not saying anything, because it's a misleading thing, because at least until the end of the 19th century, but even later, self-hate was built in to minority status to a more or less great degree. To a more or less great degree. And German Jews did not call themselves Jews. They called themselves of the Mosaic religion, because that, of course, came closer to Protestantism. And they will reform their religious service also to bring it closer in line. In other words, every minority wants to assimilate. And for Marx's father, this assimilation was baptism, late baptism. Marx was baptized already as an adolescent. He wasn't baptized as a child. So he had the entrance ticket, as they all had in those days, to culture, as they would have put it, to culture. But beyond that, I would not deny the kind of self-hate which today strikes us perhaps as excessive. Indeed, there's one more thing I must say before I come to the book. Marx's correspondence, if one of his enemies was Jewish, like LaSalle, then of course he uses anti-Semitic vocabulary to describe him. Yes? He uses anti-Semitic vocabulary to describe him. That was quite common among Jews, quite common among Jews. There's nothing special. It only seems special to us when, in a way, after the ethnic revolution of the 1960s, it seems common to us. I remember my letter that got me my first job in this great country of America, which I probably looked up in my first job. I'm not supposed to do that. It said, this gives you an idea, it said, though Professor Mossy is a Jew, he has good manners. That was how I was hired, my first job. Otherwise, I would never have gotten one, I'm sure. So those of you who are Jewish here are living in a second emancipation, but the second emancipation is very, very recent. So you mustn't, you must put this Marx in perspective, yes? I think the same could probably be said about blacks. Now, Marx's work on the Jews, he explains it, he explains Judaism from the Jew and not the Jew by his religion. That is to say, he does with Feuerbach, he accepts it. Judaism is a product of the problems of the Jew, of his imagination, of the Jewish imagination, and not, as it were, the other way around. The Jew is a product of his religion. That, of course, is against Feuerbach. And so Marx is concerned with emancipation, of course. He is concerned with total emancipation, namely with the vanishing of the Jew. Marx is not a racist. This has nothing to do with racism. He is the opposite of a racist. He believes that the Jew can vanish completely. And again, that was quite widespread. Can't imagine anybody from my generation, of course, brought up under the shadow of National Socialism and all that, who didn't wish for a long time that Judaism might vanish. I'm sure there were a lot of blacks who wished they could pass. These were different times. And Marx, therefore, wanted for Jews a more complete emancipation. So I'm not even sure that you can call this theory properly anti-Semitic. Yes? Because while the Jews now were dreadful for Marx, once the classless society came, everybody would be equal. It is, to quote a famous title of the only later communist book ever written on Jews, the vanishing of Judaism. It is still the policy, of course, of the Soviet Union under quite different circumstances. He sees Judaism as a reflection of commercialism, of usury, of the practice of what we would call the dog-eat-dog world. No doubt about that. Why? Very simply, because for him the Jew is a merchant. The Jew is a merchant. Jews were merchants or bankers. So he took the fact that Jews were merchant and bankers. And for Marx, it is commerce above all, which is, as it were, the worst outgrowth of capitalism. Marx throughout believes, not just here, Marx throughout believes and very strongly believes that commerce leads to competition. Competition leads to surplus value. Therefore, the bottom line of alienation is commerce. Commerce is the worst outgrowth. Banking, commerce are the worst outgrowths of capitalism. It leads to competition, to surplus value, which is stripped, of course, from the proletariat, to being a parasite. So the Jew becomes, in his book, a shorthand for commerce. That is to say, for this step, commerce, competition, yes? Surplus value, taking it from the proletariat, for this kind of thing. For Marx's whole theory is a theory of production. Now, I can't emphasize that enough. For Marx, everything is judged by production. How productive is it? And for Marx, commerce is not production. Commerce, or what we would call the service industries these days, is not production, and banking is usury. Now, there are two things involved here. A very odd kind, if you like, utopianism, a very odd type of Christianity, this basic opposition against money and commerce, which you have in all socialist movements, even in the apocalyptical one, yes? That odd idea that Calvin already had, that money is not productive, that production is work, and that commerce is not productive because it isn't honest work. Now, Marx was not alone in this. Nationalism had the same idea. It comes back, goes back to Locke and all of these ideas of work. It is a theory that judges everything by production. Now that's true, and why? Because Marx lived at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when indeed progress and production were very closely allied. And I'll give you a thought here that must have occurred to anybody who studies Marx, that Marx is really totally obsolete. Marxism is totally obsolete, because what can a theory based on production have to tell us in an age of scarcity? Nothing. So what can a theory based on production tell us when we are coming into an age of scarcity? Nothing at all. Because Marx's theory is based on the abundance of raw material, never occurred to him that there might not be, on work for everybody, an abundance. In other words, he had this kind of robust optimism of the industrial age, which everybody had, liberals as well. Production. And if we only produce enough, then everything will be fine. We'll abolish commerce and trade, we'll abolish usury, and you will have a society of equality. But the society of equality is predicated upon a world of plenty. Plenty, enough to go around, enough raw material. It would never occur to Karl Marx that there may not be enough to go around, that there may not be enough food or raw materials and all of this thing. That occurred only to some liberals. But it never occurred to Marx at all. He was a complete optimist about industrial society. Without that, his theory doesn't work. So that I put it to you, if one thinks of Karl Marx as a man for all seasons, a doctrine based on production can be no good in an age of scarcity. But for his ideas about the Jews, this is all important. For he uses the Jews now as a critique of commerce and a critique of liberalism. Because again, quite rightly, Marx connected liberalism and commerce. And of course, Jews were liberals in Germany, everywhere for that matter, in the 19th century. It's liberalism that had, after all, emancipated them. So in hitting liberalism as the kind of political consequence of usury, of commerce, he was stereotyping liberalism and the middle classes. What he really said here is, my criticism of the Jews is because the Jews, through no fault of their own really here, are exemplify commerce, usury, and liberalism. In other words, this whole bundle of middle class ideas. And from that, he goes on. Thus, the limit of political emancipation lies in the fact that the state can free itself from a limitation without its citizens becoming free from it, and that the state can be a free state without man being a free man. What he really says, yes, Jews were emancipated, but they weren't really emancipated. Jews aren't really emancipated. Their gift of emancipation came from the state. That means only the state is free, not man is free. Again, his criticism you see here of the Hegelian idea of the state as the framework of democracy, as the state as the framework of equality. So Jewish emancipation was a sham. What about religious freedom, for which the Jews supposedly stood? Man, therefore, was not freed from his religion, but received religious freedom. He was not freed from property, but received freedom of property. Now, that's very important, because here you can see how Marx has liberated himself from this attack on Christianity. Man, therefore, he says, was not freed from his religion by religious freedom, but he received religious freedom. In other words, real freedom is freedom from religion, not to receive the freedom of what fantasy you can follow and what abstraction you can make for yourself. Real freedom, in other words, is freedom from religion. Just as man is not freed from property, but receives freedom to have property. And finally, he sums it up. He was not freed from professional egotism, but received freedom to practice egotism professionally. So what you have there here is, I think, quite clear. Egotism, commerce, and trade, religious liberty is a sham, and so is emancipation. Therefore, Jews can really be emancipated only with the liquidation of bourgeois society. Only with the liquidation of bourgeois society can Jews be truly and finally emancipated, he tells us. The organization of society so as to abolish the preconditions of usury and hence its possibility would render the Jew impossible. His religious conviction would dissolve like a stale miasma under the pressure of the real life of the community. So what you have here again is the end. The organization of society will not only the Jew, but everybody's religion, but he's writing here about the Jew as exemplary, will dissolve everybody's religion and render the Jew an impossibility. Or, to sum it all up with his strongest and much cited words, money is the zealous one God of Israel. besides which no other god may stand. Money degrades all the gods of mankind and turns them into commodities. That is, of course, we should come to it, the fetishization of goods. Money is the universal and self-constituted value set upon all things. It has therefore robbed the whole world of both nature and man of its original value. Money is the essence of man's life and work, which have become alienated from him. This alien monster rules him, and he worships it. Now, here you have the summary. Here you have the summary. Money, as you will see, makes everything into a commodity. Feuerbach's invention of God is bent into the fetishism of goods. As Marx says in another famous passage, if you look at a jewel, you don't see its beauty. You only see its monetary worth, something that will be defined by the word reification, which I will spare you later. That is to say, it is a fetishization of God. Everything becomes an object, and the Jews are not exemplary. Now, to be sure, Marx must have known, and he must have known very well, that all this would be used by the anti-Semites, who were always looking for a Jew to attack other Jews. That adds spice to life. Anti-Semitism, to a certain extent, depends on Jews attacking other Jews. He must have known that. But anti-Semitism to him was totally unimportant, because with the revolution it would vanish and the Jews would vanish. So obviously he gave anti-Semitism a slogan and a titillation, which they always needed. There were others, obviously. Obviously, Marx must have known this. Obviously, also, there is in Marx, as in all people of that time, a dislike of the East. What Marx has to say about the Slavs, and I'll come about that next time, is pretty dreadful. What he thought about the Russians was still worse. And no doubt Marx's prejudice against the Ostjuden, the East European Jews, was there. And it may have played, I'm sure it did, a subconscious role in his analysis. Because his whole prejudice against the Poles and the Slavs, he was a Prussian in this, a man of the Rhineland in this, typical again for his time. Dreadful what he has to say about all these people. But it was quite usual for people to say that in these times. Now, Marx's encounter with his Jewishness is also not devoid of obsessiveness. That's true. He comes to it again and again. There is there something of a kind of obsession about it. And there is something also about it, and I wouldn't doubt that for a minute, of Hegel and Hegelian ideas, who thought, after all, that history progressed and that Judaism, in a way, was a fossil. But what we must not forget, that whatever change Marx went through, his view of the Slavs and his view of what we would call the Third World stayed the same. And that is relevant always to the Jewish problem, because of the East European Jews, who are the masses of Jewry. So it is always relevant to that. And here, Marx's ideas are not usually cited by his followers, because he believed that they were static. They were outside the progression of history. They were static. And thus, for example, when he wrote in 1853 an article about the future British rule of India, he hoped Britain would continue to rule India, because that was the only way to elevate the natives. To get the natives up, he never thought they would revolt. So you get, of course, this very famous matter, which caused a lot of problems for him, that he thought Russia would be the last place to revolt, because Russia didn't even have the British, good Westerners, to help them along, yes? To a higher state, as it were, in the Hegelian sense. So Lenin had to adopt revolution to what Marx and Engels thought was the most backward country. Polish Schlamperei, they called it, you know, that was a common German saying. If you don't know what Schlamperei is, Barry will translate it to you. Section. I don't know what the translation is. A Polish Schlamperei, a Russian, all that he shared. He was a man of his time. He didn't stand outside the time. But it went into his theory and undoubtedly into his view of the Jewish question. The stereotype of a Jew, unfortunately, was encouraged by Marx. If for reasons to overcome the stereotype. Again, I come back to what I said at the beginning, that every minority runs away from its stereotype. Yes, Jews run away from their stereotype, muscular Jews, Zionist Jews, blonde and blue-eyed and so on, yes. American Jews swore. Oh, I better not say that, I'll get lynched. Going out of the air, you know. So, but anyway, every minority runs away from its stereotype, clearly. And Marx firmed the stereotype, only in the end, of course, to dissolve that kind of a stereotype. And yet, in personal terms, his encounter with a young Jew was vital. His encounter with a young Jew who became again a nationalist and one of the fathers of Zionism. Eventually, and about that I must start next time, his encounter with Moses Hess was vital. So that up to now, I have taken you through Marx's youth and liberation, Hegelian attacking Christianity, his encounter with Hegel, his encounter with Feuerbach, yes? Rejecting the state, rejecting Christianity as an attack, rejecting religion as worthy of an attack, or two analyses. And the final encounter still remains, the encounter with Moses Hess. And in between, of course, the encounter with France. And I'll start with Moses Hess next time.